This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Second Contact, Not Alone, Book 2. Written by Craig A. Falconer. Performed by James Patrick Cronin.
Part 1. Kerguelen. Nothing weighs on us so heavily as a secret. Jean de La Fontaine. Wednesday. C-minus 99. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. I am hurrying, Clark McCarthy grunted as he reached into the drinks section of the family's new mega refrigerator. He could still hear the ads roaring from the TV, despite his father Henry's repeated warnings that the game was about to start. Henry, a year clear of a life-threatening and life-changing accident, had long ago come to terms with the reality that he would never walk again. He now felt lucky to be home at all, and paid more attention to his health than ever, as evidenced by the quality of the food in his easily reachable section of the refrigerator. Clark grabbed a packet of muffins from his own section after getting the beers. His pile of junk food wasn't exactly a picture of perfect nutrition, but it was better than the half-eaten takeout meals and double-strength energy drinks that dominated his younger brother Dan's section at the bottom. The first time Clark saw these energy drinks, he asked whether Dan realized how badly the additives could interact with his anti-anxiety pills. "I don't need those anymore," was all Dan had said in reply, and Clark was glad to hear it. Dan had seemed pretty happy and relaxed in the several months since then, with Clark's only concern being the amount of time he was spending in his new bedroom in the recently converted basement, which had no natural light and no real flow of fresh air. But given everything Dan had been through, and especially given the suffocating weight of the secret that had been dropped onto his unsuspecting shoulders, Clark deemed it wise to let him be and leave him to deal with everything in his own way. There was no doubt that their secret, the ultimate secret, weighed far heavier on Dan than it did on Clark, or the only other person who shared the burden, their close friend and neighbor, Emma Ford. As well as being wired differently than Dan's sometimes cripplingly conscientious mind, Clark and Emma's minds also had the benefit of being kept busy. Clark with his police work, and Emma with the extremely lucrative gig-by-gig PR consultancy business she conducted from her mountain-facing home office in the house next door. Dan, on the other hand, filled his days with whatever got him through them. He got up early every morning and kept both himself and his surroundings tidy, largely because Clark and Henry's respective backgrounds in the military and fire service meant that they wouldn't tolerate anything less. But in more general terms, they both went easy on him. Henry openly stated that he was happy to put up with Dan doing nothing productive with his time since his earnings over the last year had funded the major home modifications required to accommodate Henry's new needs, and particularly since he was still bringing in excellent money through endorsements Emma had set up many months earlier. What Henry didn't state openly was that he also understood that the global media attention Dan endured during Henry's time in the hospital, made bearable only by constant support from Clark and Emma, had taken an almost unimaginable emotional and energetic toll. But thanks to Dan's selfless decision to protect his father from the weight of the secret, Henry didn't even know the half of it. "Just one?" Henry asked when Clark placed a single cold beer on the table in front of his own chair after placing two in front of Henry's. "I think it's time I started watching my figure," Clark replied, dodging the real reason for his apparent lack of thirst. "It was two beers and no muffins, or one beer and one muffin." The truth was that Clark had an unbreakable agreement with Emma. Neither would ever have more than one drink in anyone else's company unless the other was there to keep watch. Although neither had any conscious desire to spill the secret, they both understood that the potential consequences of doing so were so great that no chances could be taken. "I think you're a few years late to start watching your figure, son," Henry quipped. "What is it they say about closing the stable door after the horse has bolted?"
Clark sat down and patted his stomach. It might have been a little bigger at 29 than it had been at 19,
but at a muscular 6'4", he carried it better than most would. He then groaned impatiently when the commercials ended and the Blitz Sports studio analysts announced that the game was going to be delayed by 10 minutes to allow spectators to reach their seats after a problem with the stadium's electronic entry system. When the studio crew cut to a sideline reporter and the music playing in the arena began to filter quietly through the TV's speakers, Clark's groan gave way to a silent headshake of disbelief. An all-too-familiar song was playing. So while you're out there in them old boots, running from your rags to riches, spare a free thought for the dead man who gave them boots their stitches. Henry placed his beer down after a long gulp and turned to Clark, smiling slightly. You know, I don't think I've heard that song for 30 years. Last year I used to hear it all the damn time, Clark said. Dan noticed it too, separately from me. Some stupid old song we'd never even heard, then suddenly it's like it was everywhere we turned. Maybe it was in a movie or an ad or something like that. Beats me. All I know is that it used to be your Uncle Pete's favorite song. Clark didn't know what to say. No one ever talked about Pete, especially not Henry. Clark had always reckoned that every family had one thing they all quietly understood not to bring up, and Uncle Pete's suicide had always been theirs. The look on Henry's face after mentioning him in passing suggested that he wouldn't welcome any follow-up questions, and Clark was only too happy to leave it there. Back on the TV, which the McCarthy men were now watching in awkward silence, the sideline reporter stopped talking halfway through a sentence and adjusted her barely visible earpiece. Folks, I've been asked to pass on a piece of information here, she said, evidently waiting for the next line. Apparently a major news incident is currently developing. Viewers can, of course, stay up to date on that over on our sister station, Blitz News. And, as for tonight's game, as you can see, I'm now joined by... Clark reached forward to pick up the remote. No, Henry said. If it was important, they would have told us what it was. I'd bet dollars to donuts it's just some run-of-the-mill political bullshit. Blitz News is dying on its ass now that there's no pressing fear to keep everyone's eyes glued to the screen. So they're just trying to grab some of the millions of viewers who tuned in for the game and are sitting at home like us, waiting out this delay. Clark put the remote down and leaned back. Makes sense, he said. Sneaky bastards. The fact that the reporter casually dived right into a time-filling interview with no further mention of the supposedly major news incident added further credence to Henry's theory, because Clark knew that she wouldn't have been able to concentrate so easily if she'd been told that something truly serious was going on. But just as Clark reached his arm forward again, this time for his beer, a sudden noise caught both his and Henry's attention. Clark! Dan bellowed, his voice distant and tinged with pain. Physical pain. Clark jumped from his chair to run towards Dan's basement, but Dan reached the already open door before he did. Dan stood there grimacing, his right hand clamped to the back of his neck. It's okay, man, Clark said, helping him to the couch. Did you have a weird dream? Dan shook his head weakly. What the hell's going on? Henry asked. Dan, are you all right, son? As Dan's grimace began to fade and he slowly lifted his hand from the easing pain at the back of his neck, he ignored the questions that hadn't even registered and asked Clark one of his own. Where's Emma? I don't know, man. Why do you need her? Clark, Dan said, widening his tear-stained eyes and lowering his voice to a whisper so that Henry wouldn't hear. I think they're coming back.
C-98. Port-au-Français Research Station, Le Grand Terre, Kerguelen Islands. Over 2,000 miles from the nearest civilian population base, Billy Kendrick and the tourists under his watch sat in a quiet dining hall awaiting the arrival of their main breakfast course. The local delicacy of scurvy-busting Kerguelen cabbage had gone down well in a warming soup, with Billy's excited tourists listening to his expertly delivered stories and theories as they ate. Billy, a once-respected archaeologist who had long ago turned his back on an academic world he deemed guilty of rejecting reality for simplicity's sake, became well known to the public as a self-styled disclosure activist during a decade spent trying to expose what he saw as the greatest cover-up of all time, the cover-up pertaining to government knowledge of intelligent extraterrestrial life. Popular and affable, Billy was more delighted than anyone when Dan McCarthy's initial bravery eventually led to the discovery of the spherical alien artifact, which forced the government to admit a truth he had long held as self-evident. The precise timing of the moment when President Slater reluctantly spoke the four magic words, "We are not alone," had been utterly perfect for Billy, coinciding as it did with his E.T. weekender in Myrtle Beach. That event's festivities had attracted tens of thousands of enthusiastic supporters, but the organizational headaches which lay behind its success paled in comparison to those Billy had encountered when planning his latest and most ambitious venture yet. The tourist group Billy was currently regaling with Kerguelen-related trivia and anecdotes from various stages in his colorful life had already been traveling with him for over a week, and they had plenty of time left before their great tour came to an end. Ever since Disclosure Day, as it had naturally come to be known, the locations mentioned in the documents which led to the modern rediscovery of an alien sphere off the coast of Argentina had become some of the most desirable tourist destinations in the world. Billy's tour began gently enough at Lake Toplitz in the Australian Alps, which Hans Kloster's infamous handwritten letter had pinpointed as the site where an alien craft was discovered by Nazi officials in April of 1938. The second stage involved a very short and very pleasant journey to Salzburg, where an alien artifact had recently been rediscovered in a storage locker belonging to the late Karl Heilig, an amateur treasure hunter and prominent archaeologist who Billy had known of professionally, but not personally. From there, each of Billy's groups proceeded to Lake Namtso in Tibet, where an alien sphere was said to have levitated from the water and into the arms of the expedition team sent to find it following Kloster's successful decoding of a map found in the alien craft. Trips to the three remaining sites of the Nazis' sphere discoveries then followed, beginning with a voyage to Kerguelen before the tour groups ventured as close as reasonably possible to the inhospitable Antarctic coastal area once known as New Swabia, and continued on to the tiny southern island of Bouvette. The great tour concluded in the coastal Argentine city of Miramar, where the famous sphere, which contained two world-changing artifacts, had been lifted from the ocean just over a year ago, some 70 years after a surrendering U-boat crew was said to have dumped it in the ocean in order to ensure it never fell into Allied hands. Each of Billy's groups contained 120 tourists, 40 of whom enjoyed a full-day land tour of Kerguelen during each of their first 3 days docked at the remote island. He told his adventurous and wealthy tourists to make the most of their time on dry land, since landings at Bouvette, their next port of call after passing New Swabia, were notoriously challenging and rare, typically requiring helicopter transportation from the ship. And although Billy had fought hard to overcome countless obstacles in arranging his ambitious Great Tour project, his insurer's refusal to cover any terrestrial activities on Bouvette Island ultimately spelled an end to his hope of including a land expedition in the itinerary. This mattered more to Billy than his tourists, who knew that the island was uninhabited anyway, and that the established history held that a Nazi crew had found the Bouvette sphere while conducting tests around the island rather than on it. Billy's eyes and body regularly drifted towards a large window during his breakfast time talk, as he never tired of the bizarre island's sights. The area immediately outside was relatively flat, in stark contrast to the eye-catchingly harsh peaks and rolling landscapes which defined other areas of Grande Terre. But there was something magical about the island that made Kerguelen the place Billy always looked forward to returning to most of all. In Billy's eyes, it was a one-of-a-kind destination worthy of all the attention it had recently garnered and more. One relatively trivial novelty which proved popular for tourist photographs were the warning signs at areas where animals regularly crossed over marked roads. Tourists took delight in posing next to these signs because the animal inside the red triangle was not a deer, nor even a bear, but rather a large seal. To some, this was symbolic of Kerguelen, home of one idiosyncrasy after another. To the surprise of many, there were deer on the remote southern island, several thousand reindeer to be precise. Following their introduction along with sheep and the less welcome proliferation of ravenous rabbits and seabird-troubling cats. Billy's tourists, meanwhile, were always warmly welcomed by most of the island's research staff. Billy was respectful in ensuring that his tourists behaved impeccably, while the money he brought in had aided many researchers by enabling upgrades to their aging equipment and transport vehicles. By far the least welcome Kerguelen residents were another group of recent arrivals, several dozen staff representing the Global Space Commission. The GSC had initially formed as the Global Shield Commission when the opening of the Argentine Sphere revealed two engraved plaques, whose messages many perceived as warnings against the imminent arrival of a hostile alien race or a threat from an incoming asteroid. When the third plaque almost entirely quashed these fears upon its discovery in Salzburg, the GSC's politically shrewd chairman, William Godfrey, wasted no time in rechristening the young organization as the Global Space Commission in a successful bid to maintain its relevance. Under Godfrey's leadership, the GSC brought the Earth's powerful nations together, pooling their resources in pursuit of a truly collaborative, brave new era of space research. The past year had seen a tremendous centralization of decision-making power, with all national space administrations soon to be confined to history and full integration procedures well underway. With an orange GSC flag now the only one flying over Port-au-Français, a handful of self-important GSC observers were never far from view. These observers were officially there to oversee the operations of staff from France's National Center for Space Studies, who had conducted research on Kerguelen for decades, without the need for such oversight. But given the highly visible GSC deployments at every location linked to the alien revelations, including at Lake Nanso, where no space-related research had ever been conducted prior to their own arrival, this official line fell apart under even the slightest of scrutiny. The GSC observers had always stayed out of Billy's way, and he had always made sure to stay out of theirs. He told a few jokes at their organization's expense every now and then, which usually raised smiles on the faces of his tourists and drew stronger laughter from the station staff, who understandably harbored intense resentment towards the outsiders who recorded their movements and activities as if they were convicts, rather than dedicated researchers. After one particularly barbed joke about William Godfrey, Billy saw several of his tourists' faces react in visible shock. "Come on, it wasn't that bad," he chuckled. But even as he spoke, the way the expressions of shock spread around the room told him that they were reacting to something else. Within another second or two, Billy noticed a change in the room's light. At that moment, he turned to the window behind him, and at the very next, he ran towards the door, immediately calling everyone to follow as quickly as they could. Outside, Billy Kendrick and his lucky tourists gazed up in awestruck silence at what was by far the most incredible thing any of them had ever seen. An impossibly bright fireball in the crystal clear sky above Kerguelen. The doors of other nearby buildings were thrown open and slammed closed as people ran out to see the incredible meteor streaking its way across the morning sky. As almost all of the tourists reached into their pockets to grab their phones in an attempt to capture some all-important selfies with the mesmerizing meteor in the background, only Billy and a few others were paying full attention at the most spectacular moment of all. The moment when the meteor exploded in an unfathomably powerful airburst. The screams began quickly, in reaction to the flash blindness some experienced when a previously beautiful sight in the sky suddenly gave way to a near-total flash, which appeared dozens of times brighter than the sun. The medics stationed on Kerguelen and the doctors on Billy's ship were in for a busy day, but no one would have any lasting problems. After the flash, a smoky trail developed in the sky, Many tourists understandably ran inside in a natural defensive reaction to the tremendous explosion, but Billy stood in astonishment at the beautiful moment which had been bestowed upon him. Billy knew his history. He knew his impact events, and he knew his bolides. All bolides, exploding meteors, were spectacular sights to behold. But observing a bolide of this magnitude? Well, that was stupendously rare. Like everyone else on Kerguelen, Billy also knew that he was slap-bang in the middle of nowhere, somewhere between Antarctica and Madagascar, and countless miles from anyone else. The odds of seeing something like this were astronomically long, and the odds of seeing something like this somewhere like this were even longer. But for it to happen while Billy was in this specific somewhere like this, not just any tiny island where he was only spending a few days, but one so central to the world-changing events surrounding Dan McCarthy's leak and the long-overdue disclosure it brought about, well, to Billy's mind, there weren't enough digits in a telephone number for those kinds of odds. And then came the sonic boom, after what he thought must have been comfortably more than a full minute. The majority of the few tourists who had so far remained at Billy's side now hastily fled for shelter, even more understandably running from a near-deafening sound which could easily have been mistaken for a heavy bombardment. One tourist with whom Billy had grown friendly during the preceding week, Janice, a retired lawyer from New Zealand, walked slowly to his side. The woman, still shielding her tender eyes despite the fireball's smoky trail being all that was left, had one simple question for the guide whose intellect and instincts she trusted greatly.
What the hell was that?
A serene smile spread across Billy's face.
Janice, my friend, that was them.
C-97. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. The presence of their father prevented Clark from pushing Dan for details on what gave him the idea that they were coming back, but he knew only too well who Dan was referring to. As Clark studied Dan's changing expression, which had begun to relax when the intense pain at the back of his neck ceased and was now veering towards something that looked more like excitement than fear, their front door swung open in a rush of motion. Emma Ford, still dressed for work, ran inside and headed straight for Dan.
"Have you seen it?" she asked, wasting no time. "Do you think it could be, you know?"
Clark forced a cough.
"None of us know what you're talking about," he said, repeatedly raising his eyebrows and subtly tilting his head towards Henry in an effort to stop Emma from saying too much.
"Is something wrong? We can talk in the kitchen if you want. My dad is trying to watch the game."
Emma nodded, then looked back to Dan, belatedly noticing the drying tears under his eyes. She squeezed his hand and silently asked him what was wrong. He responded by briefly touching the back of his neck with his other hand. Emma's free hand then instinctively reached for her own neck, which had a small remnant of a scar in exactly the same place as Dan's, but she shook her head to tell him that she hadn't felt anything.
"Hold on a second," Henry's deep voice boomed from his spot beside the couch. "Look!"
The standing trio stopped on their way to the relative privacy of the kitchen and glanced at the TV. Below the familiar sideline reporter, a breaking news banner now filled the bottom area of the screen. Breaking. Developing incident at Kerguelen.
Kerguelen? Henry continued, reaching for the remote. "Dan, did you see something about this downstairs? Is this what freaked you out?"
Dan stammered. I just saw something on my TV. Yeah, that's how I knew something weird was happening."
With Henry busy changing the channel and Clark impatiently staring at the screen to learn the nature of this developing incident, Emma continued trying to read Dan's expression.
"You really think it was them?"
she mouthed, without making much of a sound. Dan shook his head and replied at a similarly low volume,
"Whatever just happened, I know it was them."
In an interesting quirk caused by the phenomenal speed of the meteor and the reliable efficiency of satellite communication, Footage of the meteor's initial atmospheric entry had been shared around the world before the sonic boom from its explosion reached the ground. The McCarthys caught the looping footage midway through its third airing, after the flash but before the explosion. When the moment came, the TV's soundbar filled the room with a bass-heavy boom that physically startled everyone. Even Emma, who knew it was coming, hadn't been prepared for the level of this sudden burst of sound. She could only imagine what it must have sounded like in person. She turned once more to Dan, keen to see his reaction to the surely unexpected revelation that an exploding meteor had apparently been responsible for the mysterious twinge in his neck that told him something was happening before he saw or heard what it was. He looked remarkably calm, which helped to ease Emma's uncertain mind. Unfortunately, when Sarah Curtis, Dan's least favorite Blitz News anchor, returned to the airwaves beside a half-screen version of the footage after its third full airing, calmness was in short supply. "Already," Curtis began in her best fear-mongering tone, "speculation is rife that the location of this extraordinary incident, which is so obscure and remote that coincidence seems implausible, may indicate that this is some kind of deliberate message from the messengers themselves, and if that is indeed the case, it certainly seems difficult to consider that a destructive fireball from space could possibly be construed as a message of peace." Emma lifted her phone from her pocket and quickly tapped her way through a few menu options. Seconds later, she tilted the screen towards Dan. It displayed data from her social media meta-analysis app, and with a single glance, Dan could see that the incident wasn't going down well. The main mood cloud was filled with two large words, panic and fear. When Emma scrolled down, the positive-negative pie chart was a wash of red, apart from a tiny sliver of green and a slightly larger slice of uncertain blue. The straightforward trend list, which highlighted words which were being used far more than normal, contained some specific terms which didn't surprise Dan, given the nature of the aggregate reaction tracking data he had just seen. Kerguelen, Bolide, GSC, Messengers, Meteor, Godfrey, Plaque. The final word in this trending list was the one which gave Dan pause. Henry's continued presence made it impossible for Dan to candidly discuss any of this with Emma and Clark, the only others who shared his secret, but in the confusion of the moment, he didn't know what he would have said, even if he had been able to speak openly. Sarah Curtis and her studio guest, a man who had been there to talk about something else and whose identifying caption Dan had missed, wasted no time in ramping up the fear factor even further, with a word that hadn't been spoken much in the last year. Hostility.
"I think this is undoubtedly going to reignite the hostility debate," the unknown studio guest said. "A debate which we have complacently assumed to be settled ever since the third plaque turned up in Salzburg. I also believe that attention will inevitably, and rightly, turn once again to Richard Walker and his indefensible role in keeping the truth from humanity for so long."
Henry McCarthy sighed at this comment and wheeled his way around the couch. To Dan's frustrated bemusement, Henry had often voiced his view that Walker had been unfairly vilified for covering up the truth for so long during his time as head of the now-defunct Inner Space Defense Agency. Henry had no love for Walker following his frequent personal attacks on Dan, but in broader terms, he accepted that the disgraced politician had done what he'd done for unselfish and patriotic reasons. Dan held his tongue for very different reasons whenever this subject came up, but he knew full well that Henry's views on Richard Walker and the IDA would be significantly less dispassionate if he knew the whole truth. The real truth.
"I think I'm actually going to head to the grill," Henry said, making his way towards his bedroom as soon as he announced this new intention. "I haven't seen Bird in a few days, and he'll be watching the game there. Clark, you in?"
"Not tonight," Clark said. As the trio quietly understood, Henry's departure would finally give them a chance to talk openly about the remarkable situation at Kerguelen. Dan pointed towards his basement, telling Emma and Clark that he'd be waiting for them down there. but no sooner than Henry had entered his bedroom to get ready, he came right back out with his wallet and phone in his hand.
"I'll be late," he said on his way to the front door. "Nice seeing you again, Emma. Stop by for dinner sometime." "But next time," Henry trailed off and knocked three times on the open door.
"Knock." "Unless it's an emergency," she replied.
"Maybe if it's a real emergency, but if it's another glorified shooting star..."
He trailed off again, knocking another three times on the open door before going outside and pulling it closed. The second the door was closed, Emma threw her arms around Dan and hugged him tight.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
"I'm fine."
Emma then gently ran her hand across the back of Dan's neck and stepped behind him to take a look.
"Dan, it's bright red."
"I was kind of clawing at it," he said. "Pretty hard. It felt like the scar was going to burst open. I was just sitting at my desk and suddenly it was like..."
This time it was Dan who trailed off. He then opened his right palm very suddenly, fully extending his fingers.
"You know, like the scar was going to do that? My legs, my arms, everything felt stiff, and I couldn't scream. When I opened my mouth to shout for Clark, it was like my jaw was locked shut. Then it all stopped, just as quickly as it started."
"Did you really not feel anything?"
"Nothing at all," Emma confirmed. "I just saw the news and I ran here to make sure you were seeing it too."
"Listen, Dan," Clark began, his ordinarily gruff voice evidently trying to be softer than normal. "I'm not saying you're crazy, okay? I know we got into some crazy shit last year, but this... feeling it in your neck? This is batshit. Are you sure you didn't have the radio on or something? Are you sure you didn't see or hear a little snippet about a meteor at Kerguelen and it set something off?"
Dan shot a disappointed glance at Clark before turning to Emma. "We should talk about this in the basement," he told her. "Only her. It's more secure than the kitchen."
"Come on, man," Clark said. "Don't be like that. Just try to be rational. Why would you feel something but not Emma? They put the same kind of neural cable thing in her neck, right? So if you think you're going to feel something if they come back, why wouldn't she feel it too?"
"Who did they call to the cornfield?" Dan snapped, anger crossing his words for the first time.
"Who did they call to Lolo? They didn't even let you on the craft. You didn't even see them. So don't talk to me like you know how they operate."
"Enough," Emma said quietly but firmly. "We're on the same page here, and we're the only three people on this page. We're in this thing together. Why don't we just sit down right here, turn off the TV, and talk through the possibilities?"
Dan shook his head. "Basement. It's more secure."
Emma shrugged and followed Dan as he stepped towards the closed basement door.
"Leave your phone up here," he said.
"Why?"
"Security."
With Dan's expression giving little away, Emma glanced at Clark. He was already in the process of taking his own phone from his pocket and placing it on the arm of the couch. He silently encouraged Emma to do the same, thinking there was little point in getting into any arguments over small things when there was a much bigger thing to worry about. Somewhat reluctantly, Emma switched off her phone and placed it beside Clark's, locking the front door to make sure it would be safe. Having never been inside Dan's ordinarily off-limits basement, Emma was surprised to see a second door made of thick metal after he opened the first. She was even more surprised as she watched Dan unlock this inner door by placing his fingertips on its surface. The metal door then slid sideways into a recess in the wall, and he set off down the stairs. Combined with the phone issue, this was too much for Emma to let slide.
"Okay," she said. "What exactly do you have down there? Why do you need so much security?"
Dan turned around and called up the stairs in reply, answering both of her questions at once.
"This is where I keep my research."
C-96. Fiore Residence, Varese, Italy. Alone in his stately home, Timo Fiore sat wrestling with a time-sensitive decision. For years, Timo had been seen by the general public as little more than an unrelatable fat cat, a playboy billionaire who had been born into wealth rather than having earned it. Recent beneficial market fluctuations, allied with some good advice he wisely followed, now placed Timo as the second wealthiest individual in the world by most measures. By other measures, which weighed liquidity over complex stock arrangements, he was comfortably in the lead. Understandably, not everyone held particularly fond opinions of Mr. Fiore. But within communities of space enthusiasts, astronomers, and especially those involved in research relating to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, Timo had long been held in high regard for his consistent and significant investment in their fields of interest. While other rich individuals had at times funded telescope time for researchers, Timo, now a personal friend of both Billy Kendrick and Dan McCarthy, had built several state-of-the-art observatories around the world, with a particular focus on providing facilities for researchers engaged in SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. A year earlier, Timo had hit the headlines harder than ever when he put up a $100 million bounty for any government employee willing to leak concrete evidence, which could eventually lead to disclosure. That bounty ended up proving unnecessary and going unclaimed, but since then Timo had stepped forward once more and offered an even more generous reward for the discovery of the elusive fourth and final alien plaque. Despite these highly public actions, Timo knew without doubt that his next space-related move would be by far his biggest yet. His eyes flicked back and forth between a small calendar and a wall-sized television, considering the circled date on the former in relation to the potentially world-changing event being replayed on the latter. After much deliberation, the decision was made. The circled date was too far away. "Alessandro," Timo said, speaking into his phone after calling the main office of the Cavalieri Observatory just a few hundred miles east of his home. "Why are you in the office? Where's Luisa?"
"In bed. Do you know what time it is, Timo?"
Timo chuckled slightly.
"Oh, of course. But you are working hard, I trust. Taking in the news, I imagine."
"I don't know what to make of it," Alessandro Bonucci replied. "Even leaving aside the peculiarity of the location, the size of the blast is remarkable in itself. We see something like this only a few times per century."
"It is a truly remarkable event, for sure, but it is not the reason I am calling at this time of night. Well, it is the reason, but it is not my focus. Do you have any update on my delivery?"
"The delivery?" Alessandro asked, surprised Timo was talking about this when something so much more pressing was going on. "It's here. It arrived this morning."
"Is it finished? Completely?"
"To our exact specification. But why the sudden urgency? We have 8 days until the reveal."
Timo gazed again at his calendar. "That's the reason I ask. I'm moving the announcement forward."
"Why?"
Timo ignored the question. "I need you to contact whoever puts the details together and ask them to get everything ready to do it on Friday."
"Friday? Timo, you do realize that it's Wednesday night?" Alessandro asked, glancing at the clock in the corner of his computer screen.
"In fact, to be more accurate, we're already into Thursday morning. The media invites went out weeks ago. The turnout will be terrible if we move it forward with so little notice."
"They will come. Don't worry about that." Alessandro stayed quiet for a few seconds.
"Are you talking about moving the announcement forward, or are you talking moving everything forward?
And whichever it is, why?"
"Everything," Timo replied, once again dodging the other question. "I'll see you on Friday," he added with a smile. "In fact, to be more accurate, since we're already into Thursday morning, I suppose I'll see you tomorrow."
Alessandro sighed. "See you then. But I have to ask you one more time. Why don't you want to make the announcements next week, like we planned all along?"
Timo couldn't help but grin slightly at Alessandro's persistence, even though the answer to the question he kept asking wasn't exactly positive.
"Well, there must be a good reason. After all, you're the one who picked the original date, and it's only a week away."
"There is a good reason," Timo said, relenting at last. After what just happened at Kerguelen, in a week's time, I fear the world will already be a very different place.
C-95. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. The first thing Emma saw when she walked into Dan's basement was a long digital display mounted at the top of the wall in front of her. Known as a trend ticker, it looked almost like a ticker from the stock exchange. She had seen similar things for sale and knew that they could be set up to display all kinds of online feeds and personalized data. Judging by the current content of Dan's, it was evidently set to the default setting of displaying exceptionally popular comments from any online discussions which matched his keyword list. The message currently running along the trend ticker's display was a popular comment suggesting that the Kerguelen meteor might have been a guerrilla marketing stunt to promote an upcoming blockbuster movie about the search for the fourth alien plaque. Dan had been approached to make a cameo in this movie, imaginatively titled The Fourth Plaque, with the studio hoping that his previous appearances alongside Hollywood A-lister Caitlin Judd on Focus 2020 and in a Lexington Cola commercial would sway him towards accepting the lucrative offer. They didn't. Back when Emma first showed up uninvited at Dan's door as a strictly business PR representative, she had expected to find newspaper cuttings stuck to the walls and pizza boxes littering the floor. During her first descent into his newly converted basement as a very close friend, she expected the same thing. But like she had been back then, when Emma reached the bottom of the basement's stairway, she was pleasantly surprised to see that the whole place was clean and tidy. The sterile decor, or more precisely the complete lack of decor, wasn't to her taste, and she didn't like the air. But the perfectly made bed was large and comfortable looking, which momentarily made her wonder what she could do with this extra space in her own identically shaped home next door. She then noticed that Dan had an open notebook and pen at each side of his bed, as well as another on his desk and several eye-level whiteboards with magnetic pens attached. "Why so many pens?" she asked. "In case I have to write something quickly," Dan said. "You mean a message? Have you ever had to? Since Lolo, I mean?" Dan shook his head and held his hand out towards a giant desk, which looked something like a dinner table crossed with a meeting room table, encouraging Emma and Clark to each take one of its four seats. As Emma pulled a seat out from under the desk, she belatedly noticed the extensive security center, which filled the door side wall. Several large screens not only relayed live footage from the house's many external cameras, but also footage of cars passing by the old drive-in lot on the main road in and out of town. Emma knew the McCarthys were close to the lot's owner, Phil Norris, and also that he was enthusiastic about security. So the origin of this remote feed was no mystery. "Phil gave me a hookup to the drive-in's cameras," Dan said, mistakenly reading Emma's concern at his paranoia as confusion over the feed's source. "He gave me a lot of advice on this place, especially the caging." Emma hesitated, almost afraid to ask.
"Caging?"
"Yeah. When I got this place done, Phil said that if I wanted privacy, I should look into having the whole room shielded against all kinds of signals. Anti-eavesdropping measures, EMP resistance, everything like that. All of my security and computer connections are securely wired to a control box in the corner of my dad's new bedroom upstairs. There's no Wi-Fi or phone signal down here. It's safer that way." Clark shared a brief glance with Emma. Having heard all of this before, he wasn't surprised or concerned by Dan's borderline obsessive living arrangements. He understood why Emma might be, but they both knew there were more important things to think about right now. Emma took a deep breath, still uncertain about the quality of the air, and patted the desk twice with both hands to indicate that it was time for business.
"Okay, nothing is off the table here. Anyone can say whatever comes into their mind, no judgment. Is that clear? No judgment."
"Okay, so can someone tell me what the hell a bolide actually is?" Clark asked, starting off in the spirit of non-judgment.
When the headlines say Kerguelen bolide, does that mean part of the meteor actually landed on Kerguelen? Dan was happy to field this easy starter. Basically, very basically, a meteor is a chunk of rock that becomes visible when it enters our atmosphere. They burn up on their way in, and meteorites are the small parts that sometimes reach the ground. Some meteors can be so bright that they look like fireballs, but there doesn't have to be an explosion for there to be a fireball. With me so far? A bolide, specifically, is a meteor that actually explodes in the air. The fireball from a bolide can look way brighter than the sun, even if it happens in daylight, and the sonic boom can be insane. The one at Kerguelen will be detected by instruments on the other side of the world, easily. But after an explosion like that, the meteorites that turn up are usually tiny. Clark looked like he more or less understood. So does that mean there can't be anything like a sphere or a new plaque lying on Kerguelen right now? I'm not saying I think that's what's going on here, but I mean in terms of physical possibility. Nothing like that could reach the ground.
It looked like the explosion was miles and miles out to sea anyway, Emma chimed in. I'll be surprised if they find any meteorite fragments on land at all.
So what do you think is going on? Dan asked her, straight to the point.
The way I see it, there are four possible options, she replied, positioning her hand to raise one finger with each point. In no particular order, random chance, publicity stunt, false flag, and, you know.
Aliens, Clark said. You're allowed to say it. But who would do this as a publicity stunt? And what does false flag even mean?
Dan interjected. A false flag is when a person or group, usually a government, does something that forwards their goals and is done in a way that makes it look like someone else did it, like bombing your own hospitals to justify a war you want to start for some other reason, stuff like that.
He spoke quickly and dismissively, evidently thinking little of this opinion's credibility, then turned back to Emma. And I'll tell you in a minute how crazy it is to think this could be random chance, but as for the publicity stunt option, do you seriously think that a movie studio would, or even could, do something like this to promote a new release?
That sounds an awful lot like judgment, Emma said.
Dan held his hands up, quite literally. Sorry, but really... Emma accepted the apology.
But really, I didn't even mention a movie studio. There are already posts from people saying Billy Kendrick might have faked this for publicity, to sell his tours. That's obviously not what's happening, but we are trying to cover all possibilities here. I think a publicity stunt is way less likely than a false flag, because the kind of people who would benefit from a publicity stunt don't have the same resources as the people who could benefit from a false flag. For all we know, this could be Godfrey cooking up a new threat to justify more powers and funding for the GSC, or it could be someone who wants to make the GSC look weak by showing that it can't even defend us from small meteors, let alone alien laser beams or whatever else. And if you're looking for leaders of countries with a grudge against Godfrey, well, pick up an atlas and choose a page at random. Again, I'm not saying this is what I think. I'm just saying, don't rule anything out. When you've seen behind the curtain, you learn not to rule anything out, however crazy it sounds.
Seen behind the curtain? I've been behind the curtain, Dan said.
Dan? Emma said, trying hard not to smile. For almost 10 years, I was the damn curtain.
Clark leaned back in his chair. My mind keeps swinging back to random chance. It makes the most sense. Stuff falls from space all the time, right? Maybe this time it just happened to fall over Kerguelen. Emma mentioned an atlas, Dan said. If I printed out a map of the world right now and gave you 100 darts, you could throw them all night, but none would land inside Kerguelen. Do you want to know why? Because the point of the dart would be too big. That's how small Kerguelen is. And you're telling me this is chance? One of the most powerful bolides on record, probably in the top 5 of the last century. And you're telling me it just happened to show up at Kerguelen? No one replied. And none of this is even factoring in the point that I felt something, Dan went on, slapping the back of his neck over and over again.
Are we all forgetting that part? The part when I felt a shooting pain at the exact moment this happened, and in the exact spot where the messengers connected their interface cable? They wanted everyone to notice this, but they wanted me to know that there's definitely more to it than meets the eye. That's what's clear here, more than anything else. This is important. This means something.
But what? Emma said, genuinely asking. What do you think this means?
Dan tried to choose his words carefully.
It could be like a harbinger or a beacon.
Kerguelen makes everyone sit up and take notice, naturally. But I think something else is going to happen, and where it happens is what's going to count. Equilateral triangles and squares were both used on the first two plaques, so if the messengers give us two locations, we could then narrow the X mark to one of two more locations, because obviously a triangle only has 3 points. But if they give us 2 more locations to go with Kerguelen and those locations form 3 corners of a square, we'll know exactly where to look.
A new kind of science circled in the basement until Clark broke it by sharing a sentiment he didn't like, but couldn't avoid.
Dan, I'm hearing you out, okay? But all I'm hearing is the kind of stuff that if someone said it in public, they'd be locked up in a padded cell.
The truth doesn't care what people think, Dan retorted. I've been inside a spaceship. I've spoken to aliens. You really think this is crazier than that?
Clark wiped his brow uncomfortably. Don't take this the wrong way, man, but I think you should maybe start taking those pills again.
Dan said nothing for several seconds, then let out a slow and deliberate chuckle.
How could I possibly take that the wrong way?
He said in a very sharp tone, wholly at odds with his forced laughter.
Have you forgotten that the whole thing was a hoax?
Clark asked, minding his volume out of habit more than necessity, but sounding as exasperated as a quiet man could.
You're talking about what was on the first and second plaques. Walker and Closter made those things in Argentina and dumped them in the sea. How in the ever-loving fuck can any of that mean anything? It was fake. All of it was fake. F-A-K-E. Fake.
Clark, Emma whispered under her breath, touching his shoulder.
It's okay, Dan said. He sat calmly in his chair despite the barrage, looking straight into Clark's eyes.
Let it out. Better out than in.
Dan's calmness disarmed Clark and impressed Emma. He had been impressing her a lot lately, always dressing well and keeping his hair smart, and more generally, whenever she saw him, he always seemed to be far more on top of everything than he had been a year earlier when they first met. He wore the maturity well.
But if you're finished, Dan said. He waited for Clark to react and was satisfied when a nod eventually came.
Good, because it seems like there's a disconnect here about what's real and what's not. I'll tell you what I mean if you feel like you can listen without talking. Can you do that?
Don't talk to me like I'm an idiot, Clark said.
Then stop acting like one.
I'm listening, Emma chimed in, and so is Clark. Tell us exactly what you mean, no shortcuts.
So, for the next few minutes, Dan did just that.
C-94. Port Français Research Station, La Grande Terre, Kerguelen Islands.
You can't do this, Billy Kendrick protested, fighting to free his arms as 2 burly GSC Security Corps officers held him against a wall while several more escorted his frightened tour group outside to be taken back to their waiting ship.
This is a French island and I'm an American citizen, Billy yelled. Your made-up flag has no authority here and your stupid uniforms have no authority over me.
Half-eaten breakfasts lay around the room, along with the many jackets and backpacks which some less aggressive members of the island's multilingual GSC contingent had promised to bring to the ship once more pressing matters were dealt with. Billy felt annoyance more than fear, knowing that these people truly did have no legal authority to do what they were doing. But with 2 large men bearing over him, and with his disdain for their employer, anything but secret, there was a natural element of unease.
You're going to hear from my lawyers about this, he said, his voice lacking verve after several previous failures to elicit any kind of response. One of the officers then roughly forced his hand into Billy's pocket, pulling out a wallet and handing it to his colleague.
"Any recording equipment?" the man asked, a strong but unplaceable accent in his gruff voice.
"What do you mean?" Billy replied, hoping to draw a longer answer, which would give him more to go on.
Instead, the men glanced at each other before pushing Billy's stomach into the wall and forcefully commencing a thorough search of his entire person. When their search came up empty-handed, one of them spun Billy around and pointed to a chair. With fear having long since overtaken annoyance, Billy followed the officer's silent order. He sat in the chair as the men stared at him and conversed quietly with their hands covering their mouths. No answer would have come, so Billy kept the next question to himself. What the hell is going on?
C-93. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Given the length of time that had passed without any of them talking about it, and since Dan wanted to make sure that Emma and Clark were as fresh on the details as he was, he began with an explicit rundown of the nature of Richard Walker's gut-wrenching hoax. A hoax which had been so internally consistent and so carefully woven around real and verifiable events that no one had questioned it, even a full year after Disclosure Day. This was in no small part down to the way the lie had been presented, dressed up as a secret, with Walker expertly leaving a trail of breadcrumbs that made it look like he had been caught red-handed. The whole world had read the details of the supposed find in Lake Toplitz, which Hans Kloster's letter had meticulously spelled out. The whole world was likewise familiar with the sequence of events which led to the discovery of two supposedly alien plaques off the coast of Argentina, whose vivid engravings were now as cross-culturally familiar as the Mona Lisa. There was still uncertainty as to the meaning of the 280-year timescale established on one of the plaques through basic algebra and astronomical representations, but the initially acute public fears over the meaning of a representation of Earth dissected by a crosshairs-like symbol had long since faded, thanks to a more recent discovery. As Dan went to great pains to make absolutely clear to Emma and Clark, Walker's hoax ended there. What came next, while indelibly tied to the hoax, was as true could be. The trio's strength and sanity had been pushed to breaking point on the fateful night when the lines became blurred, on the fateful night when Richard Walker's guilt-ridden assistant turned up at the McCarthy's home to confess that Walker had used Dan as a pawn to convince the world that aliens existed, ostensibly in a desperate effort to halt China's then-imminent plans for a permanent lunar colony and a Martian research base. Without the irrefutable evidence they were given, they would never have believed it. But with photographs of Kloster creating the supposedly alien sphere and plaques, with alternative versions of his letter, and with two blank plaques the hoaxers had retained in case of emergency, Dan, Emma, and Clark, who had all worked tirelessly to expose what they thought was a genuine government cover-up, had no choice but to accept the horrible truth. They had bought a lie and sold it to the world. Utterly broken, Dan had told Emma and Clark that there was no way he could keep it quiet. They had seen the pain in his eyes, and they had known that he meant it. The future looked impossibly bleak. But then came Lolo. Dan perked up during his recap when he reached the part about the day he was called to a cornfield in which he received a subconscious instruction to travel to a location which meant nothing to any of them. A relatively nondescript spot in the wilderness of Lolo National Forest, some 1,000 miles away. "You both thought I was crazy then, too," he said, throwing in a rare side comment amid his focused recap. At Lolo, both Dan and Emma were invited into a bona fide alien spacecraft, where they came face to face with two humanoid extraterrestrials. Via a cable connected to his neck at one end and an alien's hand at the other, Dan learned that the aliens, the messengers, sought to maintain harmony through what they consistently referred to as minimal, necessary intervention. The messengers admitted having interfered to curtail the launch of DS-1, a GSC-administered defensive space station
which would have ultimately been armed with nuclear weaponry. DS-1 only existed because of the hysteria whipped up by Walker's hoax, so Dan had no problem in accepting the justification for this intervention. He also learned that Richard Walker had been briefly abducted and advised in no uncertain terms that any attempts to destabilize the world by gloatingly admitting to his incredible hoax would draw a second and final personal intervention. "This is the heart of it," Dan said. "The messengers went to serious lengths to do what they had to do in a way that was considered